righty, and welcome back. We're here with Mr. Michael Lejeune and Ms. Nicole Potroff again with GoPrince McCall Potroff LLC. Nicole is an attorney and a legal subject matter expert. And today we're going to be unpacking what's going on with the 8A Business Development Program. So, Nicole, thank you for being with us today. And Michael, as always, good to see you again. So this is going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carol. I assume I can kind of just take it away, right?
Yeah, so I've got a few questions for you, but if you want to dive right in, one of the first things that was kind of on the topic was I was going to say in a nutshell, which might be hard to do in a nutshell,
right?
Because I know that we've got some seasoned folks out there, but we also might have some people that are brand new and are just now hearing about this 8A program. And can you give us a little bit of a background on 8A? What's a small disadvantaged business and what's going on with the program right now that's kind of causing a stir?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to start with that. That's a great place to start. Okay, so in a nutshell, what we have, and I will say there has been just a huge spike in interest in the 8A program, and we've had reporters that generally don't do much government contracting at all, and all kinds of different people kind of wade into the waters of federal contracting recently just to kind of see what's going on with this 8A program. So I would highly expect there to be some people that are seasoned veterans and some people that don't even know what it means. So what the 8A program generally is, a program that SBA administers and runs, and it is specifically for disadvantaged businesses. So there is between about 5 and 7 requirements that are all their own beast that you need to qualify for to get into the 8A program. I'll run through the ones that really aren't relevant to the discussion today just briefly, and then I will touch on the big one. So we've got economic disadvantage. So you would need to be able to show that your company, essentially it's your financial situation, is one that is not so wealthy and so stable that you would not qualify under certain thresholds. There's 3 different thresholds. They have to do with your income, your net worth, and your total value of all your assets. So if you do qualify as economically disadvantaged, you can check that box. You've also got potential for success. So that one looks more at your company itself and wants to make sure that your company shows a potential to succeed. SBA is not looking for you to show extreme profits or anything like that, but they do need to see that your company is not either brand new and hasn't proven itself at all yet, or a company that is actually kind of operating at a loss right now. SBA is not looking for the 8A program to be the sole reason that your company is succeeding. They want to see you have that potential regardless. They, like anybody, want to see their programs work and succeed, and they're not really in the business of allowing people in that program if they don't think there's a chance of that. There's a good standing requirement. Basically, you need to be a U.S. citizen. You need to be in good standing. Generally, they'll look at your loans and taxes and things like that and just make sure you don't have giant unpaid amounts. And then really the big one that's at issue currently, since the recent Supreme Court case came down, followed by the ultimate decision out in the Eastern District of Tennessee, is the social disadvantage requirement. So for the longest time, there's been kind of a 2 pathways that you can get to the end of that social disadvantage requirement. One of them has always been being a member in what SBA calls a presumed socially disadvantaged group. So generally, that is a group that SBA lists in their social disadvantage rule, and it's a very long list, and it goes through a bunch of countries and ethnicities and races and kind of across the gambit. These tend to be marginalized groups. So groups that we have some history of oppression, some history of systematic racism is very common, things like that. And SBA created this group specifically, this list of groups, to basically have this presumed social disadvantage where you're able to say, rather than being based on your individual social disadvantage, you are simply a member of a group that we have a country, as a country, have generally just accepted is going to be disadvantaged based on history, as I mentioned, things like past wars, things like slavery, things like genocide and assimilation, and all kinds of historical reasons that you should qualify as disadvantaged on that basis. So that was kind of, I think, under the rule, it's actually like it's group B is kind of what we always called it. So you'd be a group B applicant. So you would be able to say, I qualify in one of these groups. So I meet social disadvantage. And then on the other hand, there has always been another way that you can get in. And that other way is if you do not automatically qualify. And I say automatically qualify, we will talk about that a little bit, but it is a presumption. It's a presumption that you qualified because you were a member of a group. There was still kind of a caveat in the rule that said, if SBA had concerns or felt that maybe you really truly didn't identify as that certain group, so you shouldn't be included in that group, they could ideally raise that and rebut the presumption and say, even though, for example, you have a Hispanic last name, we don't actually feel that you've held yourself out to be Hispanic. You don't look Hispanic, you don't follow the cultures, things like that. And they can, if they want to, rebut that presumption. But I will say things like automatically get in because, at least in my experience, the most I had ever seen SBA ask for along those lines was a bit more evidence. Something like, okay, well, you don't have a Hispanic last name, but you're claiming Hispanic heritage. Could you submit something that shows that your mother had Hispanic heritage? Can I see a surname? Can I see a birth certificate? Something like that. That's been the most I've ever had to do on that front to kind of ensure that presumption is put into place. So that's why I say things like automatically, because yes, it's a presumption. Very, very rarely do you see anything that really does rebut that presumption. So then on the other hand, if you were not presumed socially disadvantaged, you were able to write what's called a social disadvantage narrative. So I have been kind of our firm's social disadvantage guru from all the way back when I started at the firm as a baby attorney. And the reason was not everybody was super enthusiastic about drafting these very personal, emotional, moving legal documents. And for good reason, they are very unique aspect of what we do that is unlike any of the other very formulaic, very legal, analytical, strategic type of writing that we do. Yes, there's strategy involved in these narratives, but you are essentially taking the facts of why you believe personally. So this is not why you should be included in a group. And that's very important because SBA has had repeated statements and guidance and even the OHA case decisions that really want to make sure people understand SBA is not looking for a generalization, a statistical analysis of why women are treated differently or why some other group is treated differently. And I know, Carol, that was one of the things we had talked about mentioning, so I'll really quick touch on that. Generally, the groups that we saw get in through the social disadvantage narrative aspect, the group C applicants, if you will, because that is where it spells out how you would draft a narrative and what needs to be demonstrated in that narrative. Essentially, we would see women, probably the number one most common, and frankly, in my experience, very likely to get in, as long as I think it's fair to generalize that women in the business industry are a bit of a minority, especially where you have things like women in the construction industry, engineering industry. Those are very often the basis for social disadvantage we see set forth in the narrative. So what that narrative would talk about would be things like, as a young girl, I was told I should pursue nursing and teaching, and I should give up the dreams of being a doctor, an attorney, an engineer, things like that, which frankly is still very, very common. I've yet to have a woman applicant that just couldn't think of anything to put in her narrative, unfortunately, but also fortunately. So the other type things you'll see are like unequal pay. So if you can demonstrate that you had a contemporary, a peer in your, a colleague in your company that basically had equal qualifications, equal education, or that you were maybe even more qualified, more educated, yet they were paid more than you. That was a very strong example, is a very strong example of social disadvantage, as long as you can show the big three is kind of what I've always referred to them as. But that would be every incident that you tell SBA about. You need to basically have three big points. One of them is a plethora of details. And it is understandable and has been my experience as well that some people remember the date, how old they were, the name of the person that said the thing they said, their position, the color of their shirt, the positioning of their chair in their office. That happens. We also see people that have very much repressed most of these memories or just don't ever think about them. And therefore, the most you're going to get out of some people is something like, I believe I was a teenager. I believe it was winter. I believe it was at this school or in this area. So the more details, the better. But SBA is not necessarily looking for, and we will talk about this a bit more, but especially when it comes to women, it's not looking for the smoking gun. It doesn't need you to provide a signed statement from that guidance counselor that said, yes, I told her because she was a woman, she should be a nurse or a teacher, because we just don't. That's not something we see very often. So the big three, the details that you can find, any kind of substantiation documentation you can find, Sometimes this is something more along the lines of, for example, I had a potential client talking about redlining and how they had been a victim of redlining. And this is racial based. But what they then did is pulled some articles where the entire district that we were talking about had been accused of and found guilty of redlining. So things that kind of substantiate your claims, whether it's perfect evidence, smoking gun evidence, something that would put away someone presumed innocent until guilty type thing. It's a lower standard than that, but it's still a pretty high standard. The other two are really going to be the two analyses. So one of the analyses is going to be the analysis of why it was based on bias or discrimination. So you can show unequal treatment, you can show unfair treatment, if you will. But if it happens to be that unequal treatment was based on something other than you being a woman in this gender scenario, and really, even though you can make an argument that it was because you were a woman, it's not any more likely that it's because you were a woman than because you actually were less educated than the other individual, or they had received performance reports at a much higher level than you, or something to that extent. So you do need to show that. And I believe SBA's rules really say that you either need to prove it's based on your what's called your objective distinguishing feature. So that would have been gender in the examples we've been talking about, or you need to show why it's more likely than not that it was based on that feature. So the third big point is that you need to be able to show long-term impact. So you have to show how that event really impacted you long-term. And this is where, funny enough, we tend to see a lot of companies struggle and a lot of people struggle. And it's not so much because they can't come up with the long-term impact, but it's because they tend to kind of be under the impression that everybody can just make the logical connection. Why would being paid less hurt you in your entry and advancement in the business world? It's often not something people think they need to spell out in great detail, yet it tends to be one of the number one reasons that these narratives are denied. So really, in the unequal pay example, going into something to the extent of, I had to acquire more debt, I had to take out more loans, I didn't have the equipment I needed, I had to rent instead of buy, all of these things that would have put my company at a better overall starting position and a better position of success in the business world. So that's kind of 8A program in a nutshell over the years. Recently, what we have had, the ultimate decision came down and enjoined the SBA from using that group B, that presumption of social disadvantage. They basically said, to summarize the entire decision in a sentence or two, basically said that it is unfair and it is discriminatory for SBA to take one racial group and say, you are presumed disadvantaged based on general characteristics and a general history of disadvantage, and to take another group and say, we need a specific and personal narrative from you that is not generalized, that is not a statistical analysis, that is actually personal to you. And dichotomy kind of between what SBA was asking for there was the basis of the court decision being what it was, being and to enjoin SBA from using that presumption. They based it on kind of a equality and a discriminatory finding. So now everybody writes the narrative, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this too. And I do want to like turn it over to Carol so he can direct me and hone me in a little. 8A program is something I work in extensively, so I don't want to just go off the rails incredibly far. But in a nutshell, everybody's now writing these narratives, and the changes we've seen firsthand since everybody has been writing these narratives. And this is a big change because, for example, I have become an absolute pro at writing these gender-based narratives or narratives based on sexual orientation. I've had great success with those. Narratives based on disabilities, now both mental and physical. We've seen a lot more pushback from SBA on mental disabilities. Generally, the main reason is because you are looking at the way society treats you, the stigma that society puts on you based on a feature, not necessarily a real struggle that you had, a real hurdle. So something like, I have mental disability, I have dyslexia, I have ADHD. If you can prove that it is not based on you actually performing at a lower success rate because of those traits, but rather when somebody sees that label attached to your name, they then stigmatize you. So we can see mental disability work. Physical disabilities tend to be pretty successful. Generally, we see arguments where someone is a service-disabled vet and they lost a leg. And when they are at these potential job site, work site type meetings, and the contracting officer or their potential teaming partner sees that they are missing a leg, they instantly treat them differently. They have concerns about them managing the contract, and they basically say, yeah, we don't want to work with you anymore. And it's clearly because of that reason. So those are kind of some of the big ones. I have seen a couple people argue for religion, for being a member of a race, ethnicity, heritage that is not included in one of those groups. I've only seen that I think twice in my many years of doing this, but it happens. And I think one of the other ones is isolation. And I think SBA's rule does say something about long-term isolation. Now, what SBA really means by that, I have not seen a lot of cases. There have not been a lot of appeals that went to OHA, which if you're aware, that's one of the only ways you can actually really see into SBA's mind as to accepting or denying a narrative. So we're not really sure how successful those are or what a successful isolation argument would be, but they are tougher to make generally, because you are having to show why that's based on a certain feature. And that's kind of, I think, the difficult part for those. So now that everybody's writing narratives, and these narratives are now about everything we talked about and race, heritage, and ethnicity, we are seeing a massive increase in the amount of narratives, just the sheer amount that are needed to be reviewed. Everything from current applicants who are in the process of applying, SBA has come back and said, well, it has paused all new applications. And it has really paused all the certify portal upload capabilities generally. Now, everybody should be working on a narrative if they are trying to get into the 8A program or in the 8A program, without a doubt. Directly from the SBA, it's been said, do everything you can, be proactive, take steps now. So the unique thing about the 8A program and contracting is that when SBA and an agency decide that an award is going to go to an 8A participant, that contract is actually between SBA and the agency. This is unique, again, to the 8A program. All the other programs really work the same way any small business would work. The award's made directly to the applicant or to the participant. So for the 8A ones, the award is made. SBA has to accept that award on behalf of the participant. The basic timeline between offer and acceptance is 5 days. So we've seen all the firms that have a pending award have been given the very quick nudge from their BOS, their business opportunity specialist. You need to get this narrative in now, or you're not going to get this award. We've seen brief extensions on that 5 days, but not much. So what we suspected, even before we were told any of these details, or we actually got to see how SBA played this out, we did suspect that this would lead SBA to have to lighten up a bit on the narrative review standards. It was a pretty high standard, and we would see 10 to 20 page narratives go in and come back with, we need more information, we need more analysis regularly. So what SBA has done recently, the one big change we've seen is they've really said, okay, we're going to find a way to make these narratives easier to write, easier to get in with, but we absolutely can't remove the big three. So you still need the details, the full analysis of bias, and the full analysis of long-term impact. So what SBA has done to make that, to lighten that load a bit, is they've now said, no matter how many instances you have, pick two. Take those two instances and give me the full analysis of those. And we've seen very, very high success rates. And I know this is a biased sample because it's people that came to us for help and we're experts in this field. But generally, we've seen everybody who has written one of these narratives with our help on a short turnaround has either gotten in or has been told you're not actually pending an award, so you can't submit it yet. If you're not pending an award, so you're a participant without a pending award, or you're a new applicant, you actually can't upload it yet. But everyone that has, SBA has been quick. We've seen some same day approvals and things like that that were just historically unheard of. So that's the big 8A program nutshell, along with the current changes nutshell. And I will turn it over to Carol and we can talk about some specific details.
Wow, that was a great recap there. And that was a big nutshell, but it good was information, because I mean, there's a lot of detail in this, a lot of background. Now, Nicole, it used to be, if my memory serves me, that a point in time, the SBA did require 8A applicants, even in the presumed groups, to submit a social disadvantage. Then they moved away from that. And that's kind of what caused it once they got challenged on that. And so, yeah, because I remember I used to work at the SBA out of the Portland District office. And I remember we used to sit there and help folks go through those narratives. And people would be like, well, if I'm in a presumed group, why do I need to submit a narrative?
Right.
You know, so
right.
I guess the SBA after a while did away with that. But then now it's kind of coming back to say, no, you do need a narrative. So the other thing that is interesting about something that you said that I want to point out is that a lot of people believe that the 8A program is like a state minority business program, but it's different. And it's really socially and economically disadvantaged individuals. And so while a lot of the minority groups will apply, and that's why they had a presumed disadvantage, but like you were mentioning, women, perhaps service disabled veterans, members maybe of an LGBTQ community would all be able to look at this stuff, and really anybody who's really had discrimination or bias or whatever that meets those criteria, if you think through your history of your life and you can document that and call Nicole, she'll help you write a narrative. But that should be a qualifying factor. And I always thought that it was interesting as I see some states struggle, for example, like Arizona, with challenges to race-based type of programs like minority business programs or whatnot. Some states don't even allow it. And I always thought that was one of the ways that the SBA's program stood the test of time, because really, if you can claim the disadvantage, you can get into the program. Michael, you're sitting over there. I want to make sure you get some time in here as well. But
just listen,
what are your thoughts on everything? And then what are you guys seeing with your clients?
Sure.
By the way, Michael, before we get out of the show, if you can find that link to the article that Josh wrote up, and I know you had some input and helped him with that, but that was also a really great article with some recommendations for folks. And I want to make sure that everybody gets that link as well.
Yeah, I will put that in there. We have the style, the writing guide and all that kind of stuff linked in there and all that kind of stuff. I would say great recap from Nicole on everything going on. The most frustrating part about this whole process for me and for a lot of our clients is actually the way the SBA has handled this. When you look at the judge's decision, this goes back 30 years. That's number one. Number two, this particular case has been going on for 3 years. And so what has really upset a lot of folks in the market is the fact that, you know, this has been going on for a really long time. When you look at this particular case, you'll see the actions in this case, 200 and something plus line items that's been going on this one case over the last 3 years. The SBA did not have a backup plan. And that's really why we are on pause right now. Some people can argue that, oh, they were just being optimistic, or they didn't have a backup plan. So the technology aspect that's frozen today is really frustrating a lot of people. We don't have a timeline. That's the other part of it, is we don't have a timeline when the technology piece is going to be fixed. So as Nicole said, new applications are on hold. If you're in the program and you're antsy to get your narrative submitted, you can't unless you have a pending award. And so there is just kind of a bit of a stall right now in the program. And the other thing that I haven't heard, maybe Nicole, you've heard of this, given the stall that's happening for some of those people, I haven't seen SBA come back and extend the program for those people that are in it for 6 months or however long. And maybe they're waiting to do that till the technology is fixed and they can start accepting all the narratives and that kind of stuff. So aside from everything she covered, that's the frustration in the market right now, is just the way it's being handled, the lack of preparation, the technology aspect of it, and people that are like, hey, I want to go forward with this. This is the right time for me, but now I'm kind of stuck in this problem. So that's the negative aspect of it. For me, I think when you look at the program overall, I have seen a lot of people accepted in that probably shouldn't be. Like if they had written a narrative, you'd be like, wow, you literally had zero disadvantage, but you got in this way. And there's other people that probably should get in that weren't let in. So I think it's great to kind of shake up the system every now and then, take a look at what's going on, rewrite some of the things. So I like seeing that, me personally. And we've seen the same thing with narratives. There's been a rush. I can't tell you how many narratives I've reviewed. And the challenge for a lot of business owners is, even if they can recall something, they're not thinking about the details. So when I think about just in general, the marketing of the average person we work with or how they describe their company, it's really, really vague. And so they describe a lot of these things very, very vaguely. And as the SBA has pointed out, this is no longer about hurt feelings. This is, as Nicole pointed out, there's some loss attached to this. And that's where people miss out. I had one client that literally quantified the numbers the other day. I was like, man, this is the best narrative I've seen, because he's like, it cost me this much in student loans because we weren't allowed to participate in this particular program for the scholarships. Then it cost me this much in rent because I was denied repeatedly for apartments near the college campus. And this is what it cost me to drive back and forth. And I had to prolong my education. And this is what it, so like being able to quantify that in detail, it's so powerful for somebody to see it and just go, boom, we're going to go ahead and approve your narrative. So I think for most people, if you're struggling with your narrative, reach out to someone, whether it's Nicole and her team or us or Carol, anybody, and run it by somebody and see if they can see the detail in it. A lot of times you just need a third party to say, there's not enough detail in it. I do like the fact that now you're not going to see, hopefully, 20-page narratives anymore with 19 different things that happened in them. It's a lot easier to go deep on just two versus wide with 20 things that are only an inch deep. It's a lot easier to do that, a lot easier to recall the dates and the minor details and things like that. So I think they've made the process easier and better. I'm looking forward to hearing more about when it's going to get flipped on the technology side so that more people will be able to go ahead and move forward. Because I know there's a lot of people just waiting and antsy. I said that already, but they're like, hey, I did this. I want to get it uploaded because I don't want to get kicked out of the program or whatever, right? They're really worried about that. And rightfully so, because there's just that confusion in the market right now, which to me goes back to just the way that was handled. Like if I was running it, I would have had this prepped and been like, we're going to turn this on. And, or, hey, here's the timeline. We're making these changes and here's the dates. I would have had more clarity on that. We're like, you know, I sat in on a webinar on a Thursday and there was decisions that came down on the Friday and they're like, they had no clue on Thursday. And so like, it's moving rapidly, but the lack of timeline for folks or where to get that information, because it's not showing up on the website. It's showing up all over LinkedIn in different places, or somebody will show up in a webinar and you're like, you go to the website and it still says, hey, this thing is paused. So what do I do? Right. Again, that's just the biggest frustration in the market right now. It's just, there's not a lot of communication about it. And so people are relying on us to be out there, that be their eyes and ears and gathering all this information. So probably Mike's soapbox on for today. So.
By the way, that's some great insights there, Michael. Thank you for sharing with what you're seeing from the industry frustration perspective. I'd like to throw a tip out there for folks. So first and foremost, if you feel like you're a small disadvantaged business, when you go and register in SAM, and you may recall this, there's a checkbox. So all you have to do is check the box to say you are a small disadvantaged business. Now, to formally be eligible for set-asides in the 8A business development program and sole source contracts, you've got to go through the certification part. And so that's one thing to think about. But if you actually check that checkbox for a small disadvantaged business, or maybe you didn't, and maybe after this you will, what I would encourage you to do as a tip is just start a document of your life. And as you think about instances, maybe where you were impacted, write those down. And Nicole, one question that this might segue into is, as they go narrative to kind of document things as they think about it. And by the way, that documentation can go all the way back to your education days, even before you were in the business world. But they might come back to you with a list of 15 things. So what do you do in that situation? And like you mentioned, there used to be like 10 to 20 page applications, but now the SBA is saying you just need two. Do you basically just take the two best ones that you think and submit that? Or do you still take as many as you can and submit that into it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And one that I think you're probably going to get a different answer from most consultants and firms right now. I can tell you what we've kind of decided as a firm, and we've probably had more strategy sessions and updating each other sessions, and we've participated in all the SBA webinars and guidance and presentations that we've been able to try to really stay at the forefront of not only what's really being required here, but what's still the best way to get there. I think your question hits the nail on the head. What we have been suggesting in an ideal world, I've asked people that are now either my current clients or potential new clients that are either in the program or talking about wanting to get into the program. For these narratives now, what I think SBA, a really good bet to make sure that SBA gets what they're looking for, but also that you are not putting all your eggs in a few baskets, because really the two incident thing is concerning for a couple reasons. I think Michael, one of the big ones Michael mentioned, you are going dramatically more in depth in these two incidents than you probably would if you had 20 incidents. Even if we're going from what I've generally seen as closer to a 3 to 5 page narrative, some closer to 10, but still nothing like the 20 to 30 page narratives we saw regularly in the past. What you're doing there is you're wanting to pick the strongest, but the strongest incidents of social disadvantage, I can tell you, I would say majority of the time are not going to be what the individual or the company feels is their strongest incident of social disadvantage. And this isn't a knock on any of these business owners or disadvantaged individuals. It's important because we see narratives, we see stories that are very moving, that are very compelling, that go through incidents that really just hit your heartstrings. Those don't always necessarily meet SBA's very formulaic big three requirements. And something that the applicant thinks, well, this is just definitely the strongest incident I've had, for a lot of reasons, is not necessarily the case. For one, maybe the details aren't there. Maybe the ability to show it was based on bias really is not as strong there as it would be for something else. Maybe the long-term impact, it's less convincing, it's less compelling. It doesn't show really significant long-term impact, things like that. Also, some more simple, but also straight out of the rule type things. The treatment needs to be in America. It needs to be in the US. And I've already seen a couple narratives where people talk about treatment outside of the US because they didn't realize that limitation. I've also seen narratives that kind of venture outside of the three areas SBA likes to see these in. So education, career, employment, and business history. So those are really the three areas SBA wants you to pull from. And so we see people talking about personal events and things when they were buying a home or things like that, that could be, again, very moving, strong evidence of social disadvantage, but not quite what SBA is looking for. So all that to say, what we like to do is we like to work with a client. We would prefer they send us between 3 and 6 incidents. We then will look at those. We will come up to what we believe to be the two strongest incidents. We will talk and work with the applicant. And that's very important. I think at some of the knocking the bigger firms, but at some of the bigger firms, we've got these down to a science. We know how to write these narratives. It can be difficult to take away that personal involvement and that collaboration with the actual applicant and not just kind of run with their story, use their facts and just do everything you want with it. We still really make sure it's a back and forth process. I tell all of my clients, potential clients, current clients, that it's going to be several back and forth. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get them a draft narrative explaining why we picked the two incidents we picked. And then what we will do, what we've been doing, and we've yet to be told don't do that, is we will then kind of have some backup incidents. So we'll say, here are what I feel are my strongest incidents of social disadvantage. Incident 1, why it's biased, long-term impact. Incident 2, same story. And then we will do kind of some additional events and analysis. And that really does give SBA the ability to stop reading after incident 2 if it thinks we're in, we're good, this is great, this is all I need. But it does provide some safety net there. If SBA looks at one incident and says, I can easily approve this, but for one of the many reasons I just mentioned, maybe it's not in the US, maybe it's not really business related, maybe it's the details aren't there, maybe the analysis isn't there, they may take one of those incidents and say, this isn't good enough. But rather than have to come back to you and say, we liked 1, we didn't like 2, they then have a selection of a couple other incidents, which I do suggest you still follow that full analysis for. Whether they get looked at or not, it's great to have that safety net. Ideally, perfect world, that's what I'm wanting to do. That's what I'm advising my clients and any prospective callers that want to talk generally about what we'd like to see here, what SBA would like to see here. That's kind of, I think, the safest route to take. I have seen, interestingly enough, there is just such a subjective component here. And I think Michael touched on this a little bit too. Basically, the reviewer that accepts one thing may not be what's accepted by the next reviewer. And that's just a subjective piece of the puzzle that there's nothing we can do about yet. Keep AI in your mind, because I could see that potentially coming into play here at some point.
I was just thinking about that.
I bet you were. I think everybody's mind goes there as soon as you mention subjectiveness and bias, especially in a program targeted at bias. Anyways, we've seen some of these narratives go in that had 5 examples, and it didn't even say, here's 2, here's 3 more. And this was right around generally before we got the two incident guidance from SBA. But we had some go in that were more like 5 to 10 incidents. We did still keep them a bit shorter than we normally would have, but not substantially shorter. And we didn't eliminate incidents, and we saw same day approval. So sometimes that's great. For others, we helped basically same idea. We helped another client do a 10-page one that talked about 5 incidents, and their SBA rep came back and said, this is great. I don't want to read the whole thing. Why don't you pick 2 and come back to me with just 2? I think what was kind of implied there was these are all strong enough. So I want you to pick your top two and submit just those top two. So you will see a bit of subjectiveness in what they're reviewing, what they're accepting, and what they're approving, and what they're asking you to fix. So I think the best bet again is two and then some backups. That allows both of those to be, okay, the subjective one that wants more has more, the subjective one that wants less has less and can ignore the rest if they feel that you've already made it.
Hey, Carol, we're getting a handful of questions about specifics in the narrative, and I've listed a link to our report in there, which also has a link to the guide. I urge everybody who's asking those questions to literally go read the guide. It's not 100 pages. It's a few pages, but it shows you this is not acceptable. This is acceptable. It's very black and white. It's very easy to read. I think they did a really good job on that. And so I think the guide is very helpful for anybody who's asking questions about what's acceptable and what's not. And just to kind of touch on that a little bit more, I think one of the things people do need to understand instead of fearing is the SBA is trying to make this easy to understand because they don't want to kick people out. That's not the objective here. The objective is not to kick people out of the program. The objective is to be compliant with the courts. And I don't know if the SBA is going to continue to fight this. I know they were in court. I think it was last week or week before. I have not heard anything about that, but I did hear they were going to be in court. Don't know what happened with that. They may continue to fight this in some way. I don't know that they'll win, but their goal, the SBA, as well as the court, is not to kick people out of the program. It's just to define how you communicate that. That's really all it is. And so if we look at that, I think the court gave the SBA a roadmap for making people compliant. And it's fairly simple. Just do these few things and you'll get a checkbox. Again, I go back to, I read a lot of narratives where like, hey, I was picked on because I didn't speak English and that made me feel bad. Okay, well, how did that impact you long-term? What was the loss economically to your business? Like there's a lot of those things. Or, hey, I was in a group of kids, like my dad didn't speak English when he went to school. Carol, I don't know if you know that in Southwest Louisiana, a lot of people's parents didn't speak English, right? But it never stopped my dad from doing anything. But they would want more information about that, not just, hey, I overheard some people saying this. And that's what a lot of the narratives, when I see the first draft, that's what a lot of them are. They're like almost third party. I heard this. I know they didn't like Cajun kids or whatever, right? Or people that lived in the trailer park or whatever. And it's just being more specific. How does it apply to you? And that's the big thing where a lot of people are missing that. The people that are talking about their specific stuff are typically giving us really solid narratives. And by the way, I don't do this for a living. It's not what I do. It's just our clients happen to come to us and say, hey, you're already working on this. You know us really well. Can you take a look at our narrative? That's not what we do for the most part. But I think that's what people need to know. The government's not trying to kick you out of the program. The other thing is, I think a lot of people believe that the 8A program has stopped awarding contracts. It has not. I just pulled the data while we were talking, and I've been doing this every single week. I pulled the data for August 21st through the 27th, $3.8 billion awarded in that week, which is a slight uptick over FY22, which was around like the $3.1 billion per week being awarded. So it's still awarding at or above normal levels right now. And if you think about that, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And so that's why those people that are pending award are taking priority right now. $3.8 billion a week being awarded. There's a reason that they are in that bucket. I think it was 700 and something contracts. So there's a reason that they've kind of been pushed to the front of the line. I see a couple of things in the future on this. One is this is not going to just play out with whatever changes the SBA makes over the next few months. There's going to be probably another court case that challenges for whatever reason, right? This is ongoing in the life of government contracting, court case after court case after court case for one reason or another. So I expect some other minor changes over the next year, two, three to this program. But the big thing that I see on the horizon, and a bunch of you have mentioned this kind of tangentially, is currently none of this applies to the entity-owned folks. Well, I see an 8A suing an entity and the SBA for being, you know, in their own group, basically, and none of this applying to them. So will they win? I don't know. But that's the next big court case that I see coming over the next couple of years, because people are now going to wake up and say, wait a minute, somebody can challenge us on this. We're going to now challenge the big guys, that the multi-billion dollar companies that are in that section. It's coming. It's just a matter of, will it be next month or 3 years from now? Somebody's going to challenge one of these entity-owned companies. And who knows, will we see another change? Maybe.
I guess just to really quickly kind of piggyback off on what Michael said, currently, yeah, we're not seeing an effect on the entity owned. So any tribal nation owned, any NHO, ANC, Alaska Native Corporation, or Native Hawaiian Organization, if you don't know what those acronyms are. And it's interesting because what really stuck with me was one of the SBA presentations I watched recently. The reason given for that was that these entities did not get in relying on any presumption of social disadvantage. Their eligibility was, and I think this is nearly a direct quote, was based on social disadvantage due to their tribal affiliation, their tribal involvement, and did not have anything to do with the presumption of social disadvantage. That was not elaborated on. That was not explained in greater detail. And I don't have an answer because I've had plenty of people ask me, wait, how is that case? How are they not based on that presumption as well? And I think Michael made a good point. What, not to go into great details on what you need for a court case to be initiated or to succeed, but generally you need jurisdiction, you need standing, you need a couple different things, both personal and subject matter jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is also called standing. So what you need there is you need to be able to basically show why you are an interested party. You are either harmed by something, or why you were treated unfairly or unequally by something, kind of need that to get you in. And for that reason, we don't know for sure, but it seems like the only party that could really appeal the ultimate decision would be SBA itself currently. But we are very likely, after seeing the success in the ultimate decision, I think we're very likely to start seeing more cases like that, where individual companies come out and say, okay, I just wrote a narrative and it cost me thousands of dollars to write and took up time, and I maybe, you know, miss potential awards in the meantime. There's a lot of arguments that can be made there, but I think we are going to start seeing a lot more of the comparisons. People starting court cases saying, why is it this way for me and this way for someone else? And that's exactly what Ultima did. And I think that is a really important point. There is some fantastic information that Michael provided, and I absolutely suggest, along with him, that you check that out. I'm also going to provide a link to my firm's blog, our small GovCon blog. It's a very prominent government contracting blog and a lot of good information there. And we have an 8A contractors toolkit landing page that we just came out with that is basically only recent blogs about the court case, the SBA's actions since the court case. I took old examples of how to write a social disadvantage narrative and blogs like on things like that, and I revamped them a bit to be a little more in line with the current guidance and the current situation. So check that out. I'm going to post that in the group. Specifically, I will also post the How to Write Your Narrative, a blog that I spent a lot of time on back in the day, frankly, before most people were even aware of these narratives, and they were not as popular as they are today, currently being discussed on all wakes of news. But all that said, check out those resources and then do reach out to myself, to Michael, to another GovCon firm, to Govology, to somebody that can help you with that narrative. Another underutilized resource is your local PTAC Apex accelerators. They can be fantastic resources. They're also free. So I think that quite a few companies don't realize that's a resource, but anybody that can really direct you in writing these narratives. And the reason is, yes, we're seeing SBA be more lenient. We're seeing them accept less incidents. But along those same lines, why spend four or five drafts going back and forth with SBA on a process that's already being delayed if you could submit one that is pretty much good to go? I think the amount of time and money that you put into a couple hours of assistance from somebody, even at a legal rate, is still well worth its weight in gold right now. I think that helps tremendously. And kind of the analogy I've been making to my clients that have reached out and said, okay, it looks like I'm going to need a narrative, but I can't submit it yet. So we're just going to hang on. I've suggested I would work now. And even SBA said I would work now. I would work on those now, get those done now. Why? Because yeah, it's not open yet. And that's frustrating. We don't know when it's going to open. I saw a couple questions in there. When is it going to open? We don't know. Nobody knows. SBA has made comments about it coming soon, about them planning to fill us in on details of that soon. We don't have those details yet. So when that opens, I've kind of made the analogy of concert tickets. So if you want to go to a concert and you want a ticket to that concert, sure, maybe they don't open the doors for you to come buy tickets until 8 a.m., but there's still something to be said for the people that camped out overnight, the people that came at 4 a.m., being the first in line. If that line is going to be down the block, being the first in line is going to give you an advantage mm-hmm. over the person that's last in line, because at some point resources run out. Same thing here. Why be the last person in that line if SBA does open the door in the near future and says, okay, go ahead. Anybody that wants to submit their narrative can do it now. Don't be the last person in that line.
I have something to add to that is you don't always know when you're going to get an award. So I've had two clients who submitted sources sought more than a year ago that were all of a sudden notified on a Monday, hey, we want to award this contract to you. And what happened in both cases? Both were 8A and two separate companies. And they were notified by the SBA, hey, there's this pending award. Oh, by the way, we need this in 24 hours. That's what happened in both cases. We need this in 24 hours. And they were, one of them was a $3.1 million award. And the other one, I think it was about a $1.2 million award, and came out of the blue. It was something that, you know, that was not on their short-term radar. So there could be something that drops in your lap all of a sudden. And now you are burning the midnight oil to get this done last minute. And Nicole, I assume you don't just have 8 hours free every single day to write these. There's probably a line if I'm going to work with you or even me. I mean, you can't get on my calendar in less than probably a week a lot of times. And so if you're going to bring in an expert to help you, you might need to give them some lead time. So there's a really good reason right there to get those experts on your team looking at that. Get it done now on the off chance you happen to be in line for an award. You're not going to have a lot of time from the SBA to wait around on that.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything Michael said. And I think he raises a great point too. If you're not familiar with law firms and basically generalizations that involve things on very short timeframes versus things on more extensive timeframes, if you submit to me a narrative and you tell me you don't have any pending awards right now, but let's get to it when we can, I am still going to get to that as soon as my time frees up. We don't always know when that time's going to free up. I have protests that I think are going forward. I think 4 days in a row are completely booked, and then the client decides not to go forward. In that case, I then have a day freed up. If I've got your narrative, I'm going to work on it. We're prioritizing our current clients. Obviously, if our current clients have needs, we're prioritizing those over new clients. We've tried to not turn anyone away because we really do truly have, it's not just a business-minded motivation. We have a lot of investment in this 8A program. We want to see it work. We want to see companies get to use this. We want to see companies that haven't had the same support the 8A program can offer get that support. So we are trying to help as many people as we can right now. Now, as Michael said, if you come to me with an 8-hour turnaround and here's my narrative, I need it done in 8 hours. What I'm generally going to have to do there is I'm going to have several attorneys working on it. It's going to be me and one of my senior associates, one of my junior associates. So you're actually going to probably receive additional hours and have to pay additional money for that type of narrative on that type of short time frame than if you had given it to me with plenty of time to take a look on my own. It takes more time for both attorneys to read the entire thing cohesively, figure out exactly what they find to be the strongest points, and to really elaborate on those analyses. So if you give me more time, it actually probably is going to cost you less money. Even though that might seem counterintuitive, it's generally the case.
All right. I just got too enthralled in the conversation there, but I was going to say, Mike, great to have you with us again. I know you got to hop off and we'll let you go. So thank you for joining us. And I just say one last more thing on this show before we head out. And this is in relation to staying up to date and current. And Nicole, I'm grateful. Stephen had started out this great blog at smallgovcon.com, and you guys have kept that going. And it's been my go-to throughout the years. And I would highly encourage anyone to, you know, both check out the link that Nicole shared. You can also get direct to their blog at smallgovcon.com. There's also a link on their website when you go there to their blog. But if you want to figure out what's the latest that's happening on anything, that blog also has a little search bar in the upper right-hand corner. And if you go in there and put 8A, you're likely to see what's the latest and greatest with regards to 8A. And then you can also subscribe to their blog as well, which I would recommend. So Nicole, great job on that to you and your team for being such a great resource to keep everybody up to date on things.
Thank you, Carol.
All righty.